This is another episode of the Masters of Beautiful Achievements. What can we learn from them on how they apply natural science, systems thinking, and personal leadership to realize these beautiful achievements? My name is Alexander Prinsen, and great you are listening to this episode. If you're looking for more inspiring episodes, check out my website, mastersofbeautifulachievements.com. The link can be found here below. These conversations are made possible by our Patreon and Gumtree community. So I want to thank each of you for your monthly or even your one-time support. Your contributions enables me to create these amazing conversations. So thank you for your support. When you're not a member yet, click on the links below to join and be partners of this amazing community. If you're interested in how I can help your business create beautiful achievements, choose one of my Gumtree offers on how you want to engage with me, or contact me directly via Scope Matters website. And now, it is time to enjoy the conversation with today's masters. So welcome. Today we have another episode of the Master of Beautiful Achievements. And today Adriaan Korthuis is sitting with me at the table. He is founder of Climate Focus. And the topic for today is about climate policy, climate finance, and how that relates to climate change, and a lot about carbon credits and how everything works in that field. And Adriaan will explain that today. So welcome, Adriaan.
Thank you.
Can you tell a little bit more about yourself? Why are you founded Climate Focus, and what your core services are?
Very good. Of course, yes. So Climate Focus is, I'm a co-founder. We are celebrating our 20th anniversary this year.
Congratulations.
Yes, thank you. We are a boutique consultancy, advising on climate policy, climate finance. We are about 50 people nowadays, working globally with offices here in the Netherlands, in Amsterdam and in Rotterdam, and office in Berlin, office in Washington, D.C., and office in Bogota, in Colombia. And we are helping our clients with, say, basically how to if you want to boil everything down to one theme, it's how you finance emission reductions, and most particularly in developing countries. Our clients are quite diverse, a lot of international organizations working in the field of international development. For instance, the World Bank, other international development organizations, international development banks, ministries of environment, ministries of climate change, mostly those here in Europe, and then financing their work and their interventions in developing countries, in Africa, in Asia, in South America. On top of that, we have a number of private sector clients, mostly large corporates that are looking to purchase carbon credits as part of their own decarbonization efforts. So wanting to do something on top of their own decarbonization trajectories. And we help them find projects and basically where they can spend their money on and make sure that they're doing the right thing. And then there's a whole lot of different like related areas in which we carry out work. For instance, one of our flagship products every year is the annual assessment of the Forest Declaration. The Forest Declaration is a declaration on stopping deforestation. It was signed in Glasgow at COP26. Its predecessor was a little smaller, the New York Declaration on Forests, in which both countries and companies and other organizations have pledged to stop deforestation by 2030.
So that's in 6 years.
That's in 6 years. And we have been monitoring it now for, I think, 5 or 6 years. And so we prepare a report and getting all of the science on deforestation, all of the data on deforestation together every year. We also look on how the policies and the other measures that facilitate deforestation, how they are addressed or are not addressed. And then we basically write an assessment report.
So something like a scorecard.
And then it's, so every year in October we publish that. Huge cooperation with dozens of organizations that provide data. And then we're all very sad again because
we still
conclude that forestation has gone worse than the year before,
yeah,
and that the most governments have not addressed their policies that incentivize deforestation at all. So that basically the conclusion always is that it's good to make declarations, but it's a whole lot more difficult to implement them.
Yeah, and that is, I think, to pick that one up, I think that's a general theme at nowadays when you look at sustainability and the progress we're making on our spaceship. I always use Earth as our spaceship just to make the metaphor more closer to us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think for Europe, I know that for the water, they made a declaration that the water has to be cleaned in 2030. And a lot of governments are still lagging behind. So there is sort of, they tend to pledge a lot, and yet the action seems to be lagging behind.
There's a huge gap between pledging and,
yeah,
everywhere.
Everywhere.
Yeah, so that's both on the government side. So
yeah.
I mean, we all know the annual circus of climate conferences where they all start every year again and again and again, like, climate change is a serious and urgent affair and we're drowning and it's getting too hot and we need to do something about it. And everyone agrees a lot that this is really the last year that we can do something. And then a year later, they conclude that we have not got very much further than we did the year before. And that's on the government level.
Yeah.
But you see that also on business level. For instance, many companies nowadays subscribe to reduce their emissions,
yeah,
based on the science-based targets. So the Science-Based Target Initiative, SBTI, is a huge international organization that provides methodologies and guidelines on how large corporates can come in line with what we have agreed in the Paris Agreement.
And that's scope 1, 2, and 3.
They measure their own emissions, the emissions related to their energy use, and the emissions up in their value chain and down in their value chain.
Yeah.
So the emissions caused by the primary materials they use, but also the emissions from the products they bring into the market and so the emissions of their clients. So they do all this, and then they write a report, and then they can carry the SBTI logo and certificates, and then nothing happens. So so the next step should be they should start implementing and actually reducing. But SBTI is, I mean, it's a lovely organization and great stuff, but they so far only care about this first step, which is making an inventory of your emissions,
mm-hmm,
and defining a decarbonization strategy, decarbonization pathway is the official term.
Yeah.
But they don't have anything in place to monitor the progress of companies in
which
actually implementing that trajectory,
which is something I would expect. I mean, you have something. Okay, you're moving in the right direction, or you're
too bad. They only provide you a certificate once you have established your decarbonization pathway,
and that's it.
And that's it.
And nobody is. That's weird.
And nobody's checking afterwards.
That's weird. So every year, I mean, that's sort of like every year you can show what you have done that year without. Without acknowledging what you had to do the year before.
Yeah. So it would be good that's the challenge for SBTI and for other organizations to design a system that monitors progress and to design a system that certifies the reporting on that progress. But that's still in the making.
That's very similar to, I don't know, I know Cradle to Cradle, where you get, what is it? Bronze, gold, platinum, and I understood that platinum is the only real certificate you could have with credit security, because then everything is clean and transparent.
Yeah.
All the other two are sort of entry levels.
Yeah.
Into that.
Correct. Yeah. So there are nowadays. Perhaps we're going a bit too fast into my world of the world of carbon finance and carbon credits.
Oh, right.
So there, over the past couple of years, there has been several initiatives to basically structure and to structure decarbonization by companies and make it more transparent and make it certifiable and make sure that when companies claim they're climate neutral or carbon neutral, mm-hmm, or whatever fancy word they like to use, that it's actually supported by facts.
Yeah, yeah.
And the organization I'm talking about here is VCMI. Mm-hmm. It is the Voluntary Carbon Market Integrity Initiative.
Yeah.
And they have actually now published guidelines on when you can claim to be silver, gold, or platinum.
Yeah.
And what you need to do. And you can only carry those seals, those certificates yeah. of silver, gold, and platinum every year after you have proven that you've made progress and that you are on track. And then you can, for another year, carry their seal.
And that's something that much more... And that's concrete.
Exactly. That's become more concrete. So it's not, I mean, they launched it last year.
Yeah.
So I don't think you find any company that carries that seal yet.
I haven't.
And I don't think they have, I don't think you can already find, for instance, a certifier or an auditor that is accredited by VCMI to actually check it. But that's, so that's work in progress and in the making. And that's, in a sense, hopeful.
Yeah.
So hopeful because it provides clear guidance for companies what to do. It provides clear communication material for us as consumers to understand what they're doing and what they have done. So the moment that a company carries a VCMI gold or a VCMI platinum, you can be sure that it's not greenwashing.
Yeah.
Because that seal needs to be renewed every year and is only reissued after you've demonstrated you're on track.
And it's good because then you cannot buy it for a couple of years and then the company policy changes. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll stop and, yeah. and take another certificate.
And SBTI, so the current SBTI guy, the current SBTI references that a company can make
yeah.
is only that they have established, that they have measured their greenhouse gas footprint
yeah.
and that they have established a way how to reduce it.
Yeah.
Full stop.
Yeah. Okay. this is interesting because then it comes up for the company on the cost of investment and the return on investment on the investment they have to make to get rid of the emissions. Now, what I mean is that once they have acknowledged that they have a lot of emissions, they have to do something about it, and sure. it requires an investment. And if you have
typically, yes.
And if you have a short-term horizon, it will not fit in the in an ROI of 2 or 3 years because
yeah,
the
sure.
investment is most of the time on a much longer scale.
When you're speaking about really reducing the emissions in your value chain,
yeah,
that is serious rethinking of how you are producing and how you are carrying out your business yeah. in this world.
and that is my line of work every day.
that is your line of work.
And there is already so much innovation available that I keep being astonished that there is, as you mentioned, there is a lack of implementation, and maybe the root cause is it requires rethinking of the business model, rethinking of the economics. And rethinking of your responsibility on this planet.
There are only very few who like to really get into that, and especially in. So you see it happening in not public companies. So
yeah, SMEs.
And in larger companies that are run by families.
Okay, yeah.
Because they are able to have a long-term vision and to implement a long-term vision, whereas all of the large companies that we know, they have basically a 3 month or at most a 1 year
budget cycle
horizon, and they are reminded by their shareholders every quarter that dividends should be at so-and-so level.
Yeah.
And that is not very supportive of any long-term policy. And you've seen that with Shell. You've seen that a couple of years ago with Unilever.
Yeah, Paul Polman stepped out. And Danone, and I think,
is the same. And the moment, even when you have a forward-looking CEO, he just bounces his head against the system and then... It's really in the system.
Yeah, and from a totally different perspective, the whole regenerative agriculture is now also being hijacked by companies in the food sector. That they're doing something regenerative, and if you really look at it, it's it's doing less bad.
Sure.
But still stimulating all the chemicals on the farmland and stimulating deforestation. But going
other subject.
Yeah, other subject. Yeah, but it's good to hear that, and then for reference, it's like these are interesting times. They now call it a big transition period where the old things tend to start breaking down, and we have to make new things, and we have no idea how the new will look like for especially those with invested interest and potential stranded assets. And I can imagine that if you have stranded assets and they're on the balance sheet, what the hell are you gonna do? Because then the company can go bankrupt. But let's store that for now. Carbon credits. For me, it's still very elusive business. That's why I invited you, Adrian, just to open up the space and share with us what is the carbon credit market, and later on I want to ask you also about nitrogen and water, because there are now also initiatives finding ways to credit hydrogen from the water cycle and nitrogen and phosphate, because it seems to be a way of monetizing ecosystem services in a way. But let's start with carbon credits. Maybe it's good also from an historical perspective. Where did it originate from, and where are we nowadays with that? Because I have no idea.
Good questions. I would think so. The idea of capturing pollution in tangible units,
yeah,
comes from, but correct me, I mean, any listener that can correct me, please do, from a system back in the, I think, 1970s, 1980s in the,
oh, really?
In the US, where they wanted to reduce the emissions of sulfur from power plants,
yeah,
and they engineered a system where the pollution, the sulfur pollution by power plants, was basically put in an emissions trading system,
yeah,
where power plants who would reduce at cheaper cost could do so and then sell their, well, excess emission reductions to power plants that were not very well positioned to reduce quickly. And that worked perfectly well. I think that was the major inspiration for, and now we're making a leap towards 1997.
Yeah.
That was the year that the world agreed on the Kyoto Protocol, the first major implementation agreement on how we are going to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases,
yeah,
in the world.
1997.
Where for the first time, the idea of financing emission reductions in other countries,
mm-hmm,
through basically payments for emission reductions was laid down in an international agreement. And after it was laid down, a well-working system was set up. So the idea in the Kyoto Protocol was that, first of all, developed countries, industrialized countries, need to reduce their emissions, full stop. And at that time, it was very well acknowledged that most of the emissions were taking place in industrialized countries, and that the first responsibility to reduce those emissions was with those countries. And hence the United States and all of the countries in Europe, and to a certain extent, Russia and the countries of the Eastern Soviet bloc,
mm-hmm,
and Japan, of course, they adopted targets to reduce emissions.
And not China or India.
And not China and not India, that were really the runners-up already at that time. And at that time, already China was close to taking over the lead position from the United States and being the largest emitter in the world.
Yeah, for India, what I understood is that they are going through an industrial face the same.
But let's go back to Kyoto.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Good.
So let's go back to Kyoto. So in order to avoid that this entire Kyoto Protocol was only to be a little thing about, well, a thing of Europe and the US and Australia and Japan, they also acknowledged that the developing world would start facing the same issues soon as they were developing, and that they needed assistance, financial assistance, in building their economies in such a way that they were not going to be as dependent on fossil fuel as we were. So that is when the Clean Development Mechanism was designed, which had a double objective. In the first place, helping developing countries develop in a sustainable and clean way.
Yeah.
Hence, building solar farms and wind farms rather than coal or oil-fired or gas-fired power plants. And on the other hand, allowing all these countries in the industrialized world to support those initiatives, and by doing so, getting a little credit on basically reducing their own obligations a bit. So in practice, it meant if a wind farm was built in, say, Uganda, you can calculate how much emissions of, well, the equivalent of a oil-fired power plant that avoids. And if the Netherlands would then buy the carbon credits, so the emission avoidance units, from that wind farm in Uganda, the Netherlands could deduct that from the pledged emission reduction target that they assumed under the Kyoto Protocol.
Yeah.
So that's where, for the first time on large scale, carbon credits became, or carbon markets became instrumental in, first of all, financing emission reduction and emission avoidance projects in developing countries,
which were in high need.
Which were definitely in high need. And on the other hand, allowing those that need to reduce their emissions themselves to reduce costs in doing so. And that incentivized quite a bit. So you can criticize a lot if all of the emission reductions produced under the clean development mechanisms were one-to-one as hard as, say, for instance, an emission from a power plant here in Rotterdam. But still, you can definitely see that there's a number of large waves of investments have been triggered by this mechanism. For instance, a lot of wind farms in China, a lot of wind farms in India, a lot of the reuse of biomass in Brazil and in Mexico. Also in South America and partly in southern part of Africa, the sanitization of a lot of landfills, which were not sanitized yet. So all of the rotting gases were just evaporating into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Rotting gases is methane, a very strong greenhouse gas. And by help of the CDM, so by payments for carbon credits, it was possible, or they have done so, they have closed the landfills, installed landfill gas extraction systems and systems to destruct the rotting gases or apply the gases to produce energy, all by payments for carbon credits. Really huge undertaking and very, very successful.
This seems like a huge success story.
That is a huge success story.
How I'm just curious, how big is that on the plate? Is that a droplet or?
Of course, it's a droplet.
Yeah, I have no idea.
It is definitely a droplet. The emissions of the developed countries compared to the emissions of the developing countries are 90%, 10%, or like that. I mean, nowadays, so you need to include India and China basically as industrialized nations now. But for instance, the entire continent of Africa has about the same emissions in total as the Netherlands. Just to put it in perspective.
And Africa is already put wrongly on the map, in every map, so it's much bigger than we think.
Exactly. So it's the emission So
that's
the economy of the entire continent of Africa is tiny, and hence, I mean, economy and emissions go hand in hand.
Yeah,
Nigeria and South Africa are the biggest, the two powerhouses, and the rest doesn't count.
Oh wow.
So there you go. We often don't have a proper understanding here in the Netherlands of how huge our economy is. Our economy and, for instance, the Russian economy are comparable just in GDP.
Okay.
So just to to bring some perspective.
But then I would be curious, because in the way we're talking here also about energy consumption.
Yeah.
I'm then curious as how much energy Russia is using compared to, I mean, to what other country can you compare that? Because Russia has a big industrial base, and it's all powered by fossil fuels.
Yeah.
Just to decouple it from GDP. So I'm just curious how big that emission base is compared to the rest. I mean, I don't know if there is a list of countries.
Oh, please Google it. You'll find there's very lovely graphs where, for instance, they've redrawn the world in terms of energy consumption or in terms of emissions. Then you see
Africa.
A tiny, tiny, tiny Africa and a tiny, tiny Russia. Oh, well, a middle-sized Russia, and then a completely blown-up Middle East and a completely blown-up Europe and a completely blown-up United States, and then tiny South America.
just to put things in perspective, this is always interesting that we... I mean, I did a world travel. I've been in Africa and in Asia. I've traveled around the world for a year.
Yeah.
And what I noticed in Africa, all the concepts we're theorizing here and we put into a lot of schematics. In Africa, I'm pointing at the circular economy with the nine R's and everything. In Africa, it's just business as usual. If you have something that has a purpose for something, they find a way to repurpose it in whatever form that is.
True.
True. So circularity is in their DNA.
Yeah.
And when you go to the Western world, circularity is sort of, oh, we have to do something with our...
I don't think circularity is in their DNA. I think they're just poor.
Yeah, but the
I think that back in the days, 200 years
in Europe,
we were as circular as they were now.
So
it's just because we have too much of everything that we can afford to waste.
Yeah, or the price for materials is too low, but then we
go into
economical incentives.
Yeah,
and our
salaries are too high,
or the
cost of labor is too high. But well, so getting back to carbon markets.
Yeah.
So if you realize that the emissions caused by developing countries are just a tiny fraction of the emissions caused by ourselves here in Western Europe, here in the developed world, then you automatically realize that using carbon credits by large companies can only be a tiny, tiny bit of their effort to reduce their own emissions.
Yeah.
Because simply there are not enough emissions that you can reduce in Africa to compensate for all of the emissions that Shell, for instance, causes. So there you go. So putting it in perspective, it's all about communication. It's all about marketing. So carbon credits are only a tiny piece of the solution. If you watch it, and I'd like to bring you there, if you look at carbon markets from the perspective of the receiving country, so from of a country in Africa or a country in South America or a country in Asia, there it can be huge. Their emissions are not so much, but they don't have any financial option to basically make it better. They don't have any finance in place to protect their forest from being cut. The inconvenient truth of a forest is that it only has value when you cut it. either for selling the timber or for using the land for agriculture or other purposes.
Yeah, because
but
we
a forest as such, of course it has like ecological value, but yeah. You don't pay for that.
Yeah, no, that's what I was mentioning.
It has biodiversity value, it has value to
the climate.
To the climate, but that's not the thing you sell. That's not a thing that
we're not selling
is
at
valued
the
in our economy.
Yeah.
So hence, to protect a forest, you need, I mean, in an economic system, you need money to protect a forest. And that money is not there. If a forest has already been destroyed, you need money to plant new trees and to make sure that those trees are protected and nurtured for the next 50 years. And Congo or Cameroon or Brazil or Colombia do not have that money, so they need money from others to realize that.
Substitute the income.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's exactly where carbon markets can help. Well, you can also say, why don't the governments of the developed world provide ample finance to these countries to protect their forests, to restore their mangroves, to implement green energy rather than oil-based power plants? Why don't they do that? Well, then go to our parliament and then probably you'll get into a discussion with most of our populist politicians that don't want to spend a dime out of our borders.
No, I agree with. For me, then it comes top of mind our colonialism background, where I think was it 300-400 years ago, we were extremely good in extracting value from somewhere else and build huge beautiful cities here in the West, and yet we're starting to reckon with our past that has a cost, and the cost is now hunting us of what happened. And if solving the climate crisis will only work if you find a way for those economies to have an income besides extracting natural resources.
Exactly. So getting back to carbon. So for instance, let's get us into an example of the Congo.
Yeah.
That wants to implement a program to protect the rainforest in the Congo Basin.
And with the gorillas.
So they design a system to protect it and put stuff in place and everything, and then
What do you mean by protecting, making sure that illegal logging doesn't...
Making sure that there's no illegal logging, compensating the logging companies that had already been granted a concession.
Yeah.
Providing alternative measures of alternative sources of income for communities that live in the forest, stuff. You can quantify the results. You can quantify in both in trees that are not cut, and you can quantify it also once you start replanting in the biomass, the wood that is grown in new trees. And you can express everything in tons of tons of CO2. And then you need someone who buys that, someone who likes to use those carbon credits for a purpose. And that's where currently in what they call the voluntary carbon market, where there's quite a few companies here in Europe and in the US that purchase carbon credits to basically communicate to their clients, to their stakeholders, look at me, I'm helping reducing emissions elsewhere, and I'm good. quite often, these narratives, these stories of companies purchasing those carbon credits, in my view, go a little too far, because they often say, I've purchased carbon credits, and now I'm carbon neutral, or now I'm climate neutral, which is a very bold claim.
To say it mildly. To say it mildly.
Which is a bold claim, which they often can't
substantiate.
But in the end, they do purchase, they do finance the protection of that forest. And they do finance the regeneration of a piece of mangrove. And they do finance the improvement of cooking systems for the poorest families in, say, Ghana, what have you.
And that last example relates to the kerosene they're using or to
leads to the firewood they would otherwise use.
Okay. Chop the woods, yeah.
They chop the forest for cooking.
I've seen that myself and it was...
Yeah. When you travel through Africa, you see everywhere alongside the road, you see these bunches of firewood, of these huge sacks of charcoal. That is pieces of forest that are being for sale.
And they're cutting down their habitat just
to prepare their food.
Yeah, and to survive.
And to survive. Great. So the carbon markets are a great source of income to finance everything that is not financed commercially, that's not financed through development aid or through whatever
or not
sources that governments may provide. And it is essential. And if we want, if we ever want to come close to achieving the goals of the Paris Agreement, these things, so forest protection, forest generation, and providing clean energy to all those that don't have access to energy right now, are essential.
Yeah, ocean restoration, mangrove.
Anything. And the carbon market is a great tool to do so. Is a great tool. What we do need to regulate here is two things. First, improve the certification and monitoring methods to establish that when the Congo or when Ghana sells a carbon credit, that we can be as sure as possible that that actually represents 1 ton of CO2. Yeah, that goes already well a lot of times. It goes sometimes terribly wrong, and those times it goes terribly wrong, those hit the headlines. But generally, it can go quite well. So that's one thing that we need to improve.
Yeah, and just to elaborate on it, because from a transparency point of view, you cannot allocate that to a certain hectare where the carbon credit is being utilized or put to work. So let's say Ghana sells one credit.
Yep.
Is the chain already so transparent that you can see that in Ghana?
Oh, definitely.
On that area, my carbon credit is being
absolutely
put to
absolutely
work.
Absolutely, okay. Absolutely.
Was that the second point?
Second point is that companies need to tune their claims.
Yeah.
And need to improve on that. And the good news is there's quite a few companies that already do. And of course, the bad guys, again.
Do you have examples for those who want to look that up?
For instance, a company that's doing very well is Tarket. They are a flooring company, and they're doing awfully well. So they're first reducing the emissions in their own value chain, so making sure that all of the primary materials they buy, that they are circular and that they are renewable, and they take in a lot of old material, which they process back again into the new floors. And they, in addition to doing all of these things in their own value chain, they support projects elsewhere on the globe that produce carbon credits to basically account for, well, their ongoing emissions, and realizing that their own emission reductions only make sense if it goes well elsewhere as well.
Because from while you saying
most critically, they have it checked by third parties and they tell the true story. They don't say we are climate neutral. They just say we do a good job. And this is what we're doing.
That sounds more transparent and more logical.
And I would think, I'm quite convinced, that in the end, that is, marketing-wise, the better story.
Yeah.
If you tell a transparent story that people can understand.
And have sympathy with. And find out themselves.
And can check it. They say, hey, this is really a good company. And yeah, so it happens, and it needs to, this way of working, this way of, well, basically exercising good climate practice as a company should become more widespread. And rather than having the marketing departments of your company rule the use of carbon credits, you'd actually like that companies just do the right thing and just plainly tell their clients and tell their stakeholders what they're doing, rather than putting a label on it, buy us because we are climate neutral. There's a beer around that basically suggests that when you drink more of it, then you do better for the planet.
No, that's,
which is of course ludicrous. Yeah. Same with, I mean, one of the major oil and gas companies suggested if you pay 1 euro cent extra per liter of gasoline, then you can drive as much as you want because you will only benefit. You will only help the planet rather than destroy it.
Yeah, but
those narratives
narratives only works if you have the short cycle carbon, and fossil fuel companies are using the long cycle carbon.
Sure,
and that's where the whole.
Well, I mean, of course, talking about climate change, the major challenge of the global community is reducing emissions.
Or eliminating them, not having any emissions and turn that into
exactly.
feedstock.
Avoiding them.
Yeah,
avoiding the creation of emissions. But that will not happen overnight. Sorry for that. That will not happen overnight. And until that time, we need to use any measure we have.
But it's interesting it's interesting because if carbon credits, I mean, in a way, if let's say if it's the short cycle of carbon, and there is a difference between the long cycle and the short cycle. The short cycle is already there. Let's say a plant grows, a plant composts, emits methane, and that turns into CO2. But that's more like the natural cycle on the planet. The long cycle, I mean, it took hundreds of millions of years to create gas and oil and coal peat. And you have diamond, but that's a different process. So it took a long time, and now we're putting that in a huge, almost exponential scale up into the atmosphere, and there is no sufficient uptake of that into biomass, because it's not bad to have emission, but you need a natural system to accumulate all of that.
But we're talking now about different things, right? I mean, companies, on the one hand, companies doing their best to reduce emissions and to help emission reductions elsewhere, which is micro and which is what every company needs to do.
Yeah.
On the bigger scale, of course, I mean, if you look at our economies over the past 200 years, we have indeed burnt the organic material that has been stored in our subsoil for hundreds of millions of years. That's not a good thing. All of that CO2 that was emitted has not been absorbed by either the oceans or our forests in that same 200 years.
The ocean has, but that's another...
Yeah, so we need to do something. We need to do something about that. We need to basically capture that CO2 out of the atmosphere again and store it somewhere.
Yeah.
In addition to reorganizing our economy in such a way that we don't emit much more. So it's stopping the emissions and cleaning up what we have already spoiled.
Yeah. And what
two things.
Yeah. but it's a good point. And what I was getting towards is because the analogy that you can finance the biomass that is still there, and the biomass for me is forest or mangroves or the biodiversity that's there. And then you triggered me that if that is such a lively market, I don't know if there is enough carbon credits available and can be put to use. I don't know if there is.
No, there's not.
Okay, so then we have a scarcity issue, but I was I was sort of thinking, because then you can finance the innovation to make sure that these companies turn that emission into new products, because that technology requires investment. But if you don't have enough carbon credits available, then as you mentioned, they should go to the countries to make sure that they keep the forests in the ground instead of chopping them.
Yeah.
And then you need make sure that it stays that way.
Yeah.
And then the Western world has an innovation challenge just to make sure that we change our mindset. Because there are so many examples, for instance, I think it was Covesta that turned CO2 into biofuels, on gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a company called LanzaTech, which in Europe here is located in Ghent, and they convert the CO2 and the CO of acrylamethyl into chemical drop-ins using bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
So acrylamethyl...
But that's still emissions.
Yeah, but emissions are put to use for bacteria. So bacteria use it as feedstock.
Exactly. And then?
And then it becomes... Then
it becomes biomass?
No, then it becomes biomass, but it becomes acids. And acids are gasoline, ethylene, what the whole chemical industry needs.
And which we burn again in the end.
Well, but if it turns into plastic, and then we put the plastic into an incinerator. If you follow that route.
Yeah. I think what we need to do, what we need to realize, is we need to separate the macro and the micro thing.
Yeah.
So talking macro, then we have two major challenges, which is first stop emissions.
Yeah.
Or decrease emissions. So stop the bleeding.
Yeah.
And second, clean up what we have wasted.
Yeah.
And I think we need to really...
Do both.
Do both, and realize that these are two different challenges. So cleaning up the business means sucking CO2 out of the air and storing it permanently somewhere.
Preferably in biomass, but that's my personal opinion.
There can be a huge debate on how you want to store it, whether you want to store it in biomass, or whether you want to store it geologically, or whether you want to store it in underground or whatever. So get it out of the atmosphere and store it. That's so the cleaning up stuff.
Yeah.
While cleaning up doesn't make any sense as long as we continue emitting. So that's the double challenge of mitigating climate change.
Yeah.
Cleaning up the mess that we have already made is merely a technological and a financial challenge.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we do it and who pays for it? Stop the bleeding, stop the emissions is in a sense a way more complex question, because that addresses how we have structured and how we have structured our economy, and how we're living, and how all of the people who have not yet reached our level of welfare, of well-being, and want to achieve that, how are they going to do it?
Yeah, you just remind me of the guy in the U.S. From the Rocky Mountain Institute.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote a book on that how...
Jules Cortenhorst?
No. His name will come later. But he wrote a book about how our economy is structured around fossil... basically about combustion.
Absolutely.
And that drives everything. I was on a presentation last week, and somebody broke down where the carbon is going, and I think in his graph it was 70% was for the production of electrons and heat,
sure,
and just 10 or 20% for polymers,
sure,
and that was for me sort of like mind-boggling that the combustion engine has been so successful
and has brought us a lot of good. I mean, the fact that we are sitting here in this room, here in this city, with our level of comfort and our level of health And we have never been as healthy, as wealthy, as happy, as careless as humanity in any time of history.
The last one is good. Careless, yeah.
Carefree.
Yeah. But we forgot to care.
I think so.
Yeah.
But, I mean, so let's acknowledge that.
Yeah.
But for human's sake, fossil fuel has brought us a lot of advantages and a lot of, the world was
accelerated.
Was a very dreadful place for 200 years, until 200 years. And life expectancy here in the West, in Western Europe, was perhaps 30, 40 years.
Yeah, but there was life expectancy, I think, in general around the globe.
So, I mean, thanks to fossil fuel, we have a life expectancy of 85.
Yeah, and then you can have a lot of thoughts about that, but that's not for this conversation. That's for another one.
But we all agree that that this is not sustainable in the longer run, and that we need to act. So the two challenges are stop the bleeding, so stop the use of fossil fuel and the emissions of greenhouse gases, and on the other hand, clean up the mess.
Yeah. What's interesting is if you look at the deforestation rate, and if you look at the ocean acidification rate,
mm-hmm.
and the acidification of ocean is CO2 related,
mm-hmm.
And you see that the biomass reduction in oceans, the number of the number of biomass available in oceans at the moment is drastically lower than 20 years ago. We are mm-hmm. basically fishing empty our oceans,
mm-hmm.
and these are also carbon storage units. If you bring it down to just the molecular level, so if we eradicate forests, if we eradicate life in the oceans, and the oceans become full of CO2, the conclusion is we need to bring life back, just to make sure that we mitigate the CO2. CO2, but that is something that also biological life has a longer uptake than
mm-hmm.
what we preferably want.
Yeah, I don't think I can really comment on this because I know
very
little about oceans and ocean life.
No, but that's something I discovered during my world tour, and people talked to me about. But getting back to carbon credits, because in a way, what you're mentioning, it is a leverage I would not say mitigate, but just to help other countries not fall in the same pitfall.
Exactly. Yes.
And
it's, I would think it is a obligation of every country here in the developed world. And hence, for every company in the developed world to acknowledge that we are also responsible to help others in their sustainable development and in making sure that they don't make the same mistakes as we did. And of course, you can have an additional moral discussion on it, that our level of welfare is largely dependent on, well, our colonial past and everything we extracted from the colonies in Africa, South America, and Asia. But even without that moral discussion, which many people will not like.
But it's a way of giving back.
You can also simply say our emission reductions don't have any effect if we at the same time do not help others in avoiding to become like ourselves.
And then you talk about value chain responsibility.
Yes,
because in we are all connected, so you should take care of others in that way. But that challenge is just the CSR of big companies, because how far is your responsibility going? Two questions that pop up: how is the CSRD? Is CSRD connected in some way with the carbon credits? And if so, in what way? And if not. Next question.
next question. I'm not an expert on CSRD, so
okay.
I know it's there. I know some of my clients are subject to CSRD. Full stop.
Yeah. Okay. because the carbon credits, as you're sharing it has brought good things, and And that's another question, because last two, three years ago there was a boom in blockchain, and blockchain as a way to make the carbon credits transparent. There were companies who want to set up satellites and then
mm-hmm.
watch the area where you bought your carbon credit from.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it was like, man, that technology you're using is already emitting so much carbon credit, so much carbon. What is the use of this transparency? Is it a little bit too much?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry. There's a lot of stuff that is
hyped,
which does not add much substance,
and no.
does not add much value to solving the problem.
So stop. No, but just because you're the expert, I just want to throw that at you.
Has been a lot of stuff in the carbon credit world. There's been a lot of buzz going on
yeah.
tokenization of
yeah,
carbon,
for, yeah, I think that
carbon
was
credits. And then getting it into a blockchain, whatever. I don't understand blockchain, but I didn't understand. So I've been called by these guys that wanted to check if I were interested or whether our company was interested in contributing to putting carbon credits in a blockchain, and they couldn't explain me what problem it would solve, so I quit.
Fair deal, but then, and blockchain requires so much energy, so that it's sort of yeah. like it's like when you go to space, the extra kilo you're adding requires so much extra
whatever
fuel, and that adds up.
I had them on the phone for an hour, and they couldn't explain what it would bring us.
That's good.
And then I just thought, I don't waste my time on it.
And within the agricultural sector, you're now seeing companies adding new molecules to the credit system. For instance, nitrogen, phosphate, sulfate.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you structure it well and have the highest standards in transparency,
mm-hmm.
it works.
What works?
The carbon credit system.
Sure.
So, but we also know that hydrogen has an important role to play. Without carbon, we have no hydrogen, because those are related, and it's the same with nitrate and phosphate. They are now exploring how you can add more molecules to the credit system, just to
the credit system.
Yeah, I mean the credit system, as in, you know, carbon credits, nitrogen credits, phosphate credits,
biodiversity credits.
For instance, to help the agricultural sector to find better business models, so that it's more like linking it to ecosystem services. Do you know anything what's happening in that space? Because it has risen my curiosity, but still I find it hard that we start to monetize everything that nature provides and
I have a couple of comments.
Yeah.
The fact that it is so successful in carbon,
yeah,
so in CO2 emissions, is that climate change and the emissions of CO2 are a global thing. So the effects of CO2 emissions take place on a global level. It doesn't matter if you emit a ton of CO2 here or in Brazil or in Australia. And that makes the ton of CO2 as a pivotal unit in a carbon credit market, in a carbon credit system, so nice, because it is actually the same.
Yeah, it's standardized in that way.
It is standardized. Yeah. And whether I emit or reduce a unit here or a unit in Australia is the same thing. The other things you're mentioning, nitrogen and phosphorus and biodiversity and water and, well, what name it, there the problems are local or regional.
Mm-hmm.
And hence an effect on biodiversity or an effect on the nitrogen cycle will have local effects. But if I, as a company or as an individual, would buy a nitrogen credit from Kenya, if that would exist, then the only thing I can tell is I've contributed to reducing the problem in Kenya. But it has not helped anything that I suffer from here as well. which is the case when you buy a carbon credit from Kenya, because that emission avoided affects me here as well.
Yeah.
It's all narrative. Yeah. I mean, I think the success of the carbon credit market is very much funded in that the emissions of CO2 and the other greenhouse gases are a global issue and the effects are global. Other than that, they are easily unifiable. You can easily define them in a unit. Whereas, for instance, biodiversity, which they're trying to capture into unit, well, based on the success of carbon markets, they try to make markets of all things we want to achieve. But the big problem is that you can't standardize it. You can't. So a biodiversity unit, whatever it may be, number of flowers here in the Netherlands, here, how would you compare those to the biodiversity in Brazil or the biodiversity in a Russian tundra or what have you?
Yeah, because
then still, if you even were able to do so, then why? What would be the narrative by which a company here would be incentivized to buy a biodiversity credit from a Russian tundra?
Yeah, and while you're explaining it becomes evident that the CO2 credit is correlated to a combustion engine, and we use that everywhere, so that is easy. But if you go to nitrogen or hydrogen or whatever, it becomes a much bigger system, and as you mentioned, it's more localized, so then there are more vectors influencing that unit.
And let's be clear, carbon markets are far from perfect. They're only a very tiny piece to the solution of the financing problem of addressing climate change. They can do nicely, but they're only a tiny solution. And in all of these other problems, I have my sincere doubts whether a credit system with demand and supply would make sense. Probably it would be possible to create supply. I mean, you need to have a harmonized calculation method and then you can produce credits. But who the hell is going to buy this?
Yeah, that touches the economic system and how we have created the way we measure our economy. Because in a way, you turn it into ecosystem services and our current economic thinking has externalized everything that is related to nature.
Exactly.
And as long as you externalize nature, credits will not solve that problem. At least that's the conclusion.
No, but we are almost 10 billion people on this planet. I don't think we have it in our hand to change the way how we address nature, the 10 billion of us.
No, nature will change us.
So better use the mechanisms and so I mean, from a moral point of view, I can criticize why we economize everything, but that's the way it works.
At least for the moment.
At least for the foreseeable future.
because I still want Kate Rodoth here on the podcast because her book, The Donut Economy, the first two or three chapters was all about how the economy evolved through time. And there were, in the beginning, a lot of economists who included ecology in their science, of whatever you could call it, science. Yeah. And there was somewhere in time that the movement split up. The rational economists want to turn that into a science, and then they had to take out the whole ecological part.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where all the trouble started. And I'm also following the guy from Triodos, Hans Stegeman.
Hans Stegeman.
And he also is bringing it down to how we have defined how economics have defined the economy and what it related to that.
And all these people have a perfect analysis on where and how it went wrong, but they don't have an answer how we turned it back.
No, and that's true because
so the analysis is right. Yeah, and from a historical perspective, it's all right.
Yeah. But how do you undo
and now? What is our perspective of changing it?
They
remain awfully silent.
Yeah, but then we run into big institutions.
Well, then we run into the system.
Yeah,
into the system of which we make part.
Yeah, I agree.
And we can separate ourselves and create a micro community that does things completely differently, but that doesn't address the 10 billion people on this planet.
Because I've learned that in law it's written down that at least in the Netherlands, if you have turned your business into a legal form,
mm-hmm.
it states that you have to make profit. That's sort of written in law.
Okay.
And that's done also in all the other countries. So that's the system. Somebody wrote it somewhere down, and everybody can say, yeah, it's here. So we need to change the rules of the game, which is not so easy if the system has invested interests. Is there anything else I forgot to ask about carbon credits? Because this is
probably a lot, but
no, it helps to understand. For me, for now, it helps to understand why. I mean, it's easy to link combustion to CO2, and it is a uniform unit everywhere in the world because a combustion engine works in the same way. It emits something, and that has a unit. I didn't know that it had a huge impact for undeveloped countries, which I'm honestly amazed that it actually has worked, because they have big challenges electrifying their own society, because there is a huge need for that, and decentralized systems tend to be the solution on continents where.
So I'd like to make one remark, and then we might wrap up. So currently there is a lot, over the past year and a half, there's been a lot of criticism here in Europe, but also less so in the United States, on carbon markets.
Yeah.
And there have been huge articles in the news, in The Guardian, in Follow the Money, in Die Zeit in Germany, on basically the malfunctioning of carbon markets. And what strikes me there, that they, without an exception, bash the system from a developed world perspective, never taking into account that they are aiming to destroy a system that brings valuable finance to developing countries, which, without their knowledge or without their realizing so, they are just being utterly colonial again. And they're just ignoring the effect that discrediting carbon markets will have on the development of developing countries, and the disastrous effect it will have on protecting our tropical forests and what have you. And that is a major mistake and a major regret.
Yeah, because to conclude, because I have done a case study that was in Colombia. Las Gaviotas, I don't know if you have ever heard of that from your team. They already were doing it in the, I think, 80s, 70s, 80s.
Mm-hmm.
They were using the then carbon credit system to reforest a part of a savanna, but it was sort of deforested by the Spanish. That's how the story goes. And this guy, Pablo, and I forgot his last name, set out to bring nature back, and he used the carbon credits to pay for the investment of the trees, the species, and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought back more than 4,000 hectares of original Amazon forest. Mm-hmm. Even the rain came back, and the birds came back, and seeds from 4,000 mm-hmm. kilometers away all started coming down on their area. And that was he was only able to do that through carbon credits, because otherwise he would not have been financed.
Nice story. I don't know it.
Yeah, but that's sort of, but that is just to emphasize your point that although it's flawed by some, the majority is still working to show that it has societal benefits for those who are receiving it.
It can have huge, and it has huge societal benefits in developing countries.
So long live carbon credit.
It's a good, I mean, like who said that about democracy?
Mm-hmm.
No, so it's a fine system. So it doesn't solve the world, but it's helpful.
Thank you, Adrian. I'm pleased you took time to listen to the whole episode. Why not consider joining my Patreon to support me in creating more of these conversations? Or even rate my podcast in your favorite podcast app. Thank you again for listening, and join me next time.